The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Welcome back, everyone, to Global Reach, the show that helps your business find opportunities, manage risks, and develop strategies for winning in the global marketplace. This is part two of our conversation with pioneering shareholder activist and corporate governance advisor, Robert A. G. Monks. He's the author of the controversial new book, Citizens Disunited, Passive Investors, Drone CEOs, and the Corporate Capture of the American Dream. Joining him are Charlie Cobb, president of the French American Foundation U.S., this is the principal non-governmental organization that links France and the United States. And we've also got returning Bruce Fried. He's the head of the Center for Political Accountability in Washington. This discussion is part of the Global Reach series, The Arrogance of Institutions, the growing disconnect between our institutions and the people that they are supposed to serve, and the implications of that disconnect for global business, the global economy, and the continued viability of the democracies. Bob Monks charges that corporate power has captured America. He says shareholders today no longer own, except in the narrowest legal sense, the corporations that they have invested in. Emboldened by the Supreme Court and enabled by a compliant Congress and compromised regulators, America's CEOs have staged a corporate coup d'etat. Last week, we explored many dimensions of this corporate capture. This week, we're going to focus on what the corporate capture of the U.S. political system has to do with the U.S. government shutdown, and more importantly, with the deepening threat that an anti-government group of Republican congressmen will destroy the full faith and credit of the United States and erode its global leadership for decades to come. This is a problem that any global business has to consider. We will also explore what we as individuals, business leaders, and investors can do to put things back on track. Welcome back, gentlemen. Briefly, I want to remind you in the audience about the background of my guests, because this is important as the context for our conversation. You might think I've got a bunch of wild-eyed left-wingers on this show. Not so. Bob Monks has not only written widely about shareholder rights, shareholder responsibilities, corporate governance, and the corporate impact on society and global corporate issues. He is the founder of Institutional Shareholder Services. And beyond that, President Ronald Reagan appointed him as director of the United States Synthetic Fuels Corporation. Reagan also appointed him as one of the founding trustees of the Federal Employees Retirement System. Charlie Cobb was also a Ronald Reagan appointee, and during the George H. Bush administration, he was deputy assistant to the president for domestic policy. Until July of 2012, he served as president of the Committee for Economic Development. This is a leading nonpartisan, business-led research and policy organization that promotes sound macroeconomic policy affecting the U.S. economy. During the Bush 1 administration, he also held position in the Office of Management and Budget and the U.S. Department of Education. Bruce Fried is the president and founder of the Center for Political Accountability. This important nonprofit, nonpartisan organization was created to bring transparency and accountability to corporate political spending, and Bruce works regularly with corporate boards of the leading corporations in the United States. A Additionally, he's on the advisory board of the Zicklin Center for Business Ethics Research at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Bruce also spent a decade on Capitol Hill as chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee. He was a staff director of a House subcommittee, and he was a senior aide to two members of the House leadership. So this is a really heavyweight group of people, and certainly not a group of wide-eyed socialists or radicals, but a group of people very concerned with corporate governance and leadership and the functioning of the United States. So before we look at the remedy, let's look at current events. We're in the second week of an unnecessary and internationally damaging shutdown of the U.S. government. Can either of you or any of you name a better example of the arrogance of institutions in this government shutdown?
I think it's a really incredible example of what I was trying to describe in my book, Citizens Disunited, is essentially we now have a minority group of Republican congressmen. Remember, I'm a person who used to be the Republican chairman of two states, Maine and Massachusetts, at different times, and I still am a Republican. The Republican minority is, in effect, saying, we're not going to play. Last year, we had the Occupy movement on the left side saying, we're not going to play. And what we're seeing now is outside of the traditional institution of the political parties, we are seeing people say, we would rather die than go along with the misery of these political parties. And I believe that what that says is that both parties have been co-opted by the Chamber of Commerce. And you'll notice the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable are spinning their wheels over the shutdown because the people who are opposing them are people who they haven't bought. And so I think we're now seeing the most dramatic example of the American experience, which is not committed to efficiency, but the American experience of saying, you know, sooner or later, somebody comes up with something that's the right idea, and they stop these guys. And that is a little bit of what's going on now.
Bob, I understand why you're mentioning Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party together. There is a lot of anger on both the left and right. But you really have to distinguish the Occupy movement, which came together pretty spontaneously, from the Tea Party, which was largely funded and scripted by radical conservatives like Dick Armey and his Freedom Works, Foster Freeze, and the Koch brothers, who are all big political donors and have donated to a lot of those 80 Tea Party Republicans who are now giving us a problem in terms of the debt ceiling and the continuing resolution.
If this is Bruce, if I could just add one thing. Bob said that these are folks that the Chamber and the BRT haven't bought, but I think a real problem is that they helped elect them back in 2010. And, you know, this gets into the whole issue of the role of money and of corporate money in politics and, should we say, unintended consequences.
Hey, this is Charlie Cobb. Let me, if I could, follow on with what Bob said. I too, happen to be and still am a Republican, having held appointments from both Ronald Reagan and President George H.W. Bush. Let me give you a more cynical view on what I think is going on. The shutdown is small potatoes. The real issue here is the debt ceiling. And it just occurred to me this afternoon what's really going on, and I don't think anyone's talking about it. I think there's a bigger issue here. And the issue is that the current House position on the debt ceiling, in my view, is really not a bluff. And if you think about what happened in the sequester, remember in the sequester late last year, early this year, nobody thought that it would ever happen. The Democrats would come to the table because they didn't want to be squeezed on domestic policy, and Republicans would come to the table because they didn't want to be squeezed on defense policy. Guess what happened? They both got squeezed. And my point here is very simple. The minority that's driving this policy actually wants the country to go over the cliff on October 17th. Why do they do that? It's very simple in my view. Because going over the cliff, defaulting on our debt for the first time, will create chaos. And more importantly, it will drive up interest rates. And if your long-term goal is to shrink the size of government, there is no better way to do it than to increase the cost of borrowing, making future annual deficits even that more costly.
Wow.
And also, when you roll over the short-term debt, the $16-plus trillion in debt, most of which is short-term, you're going to be rolling it over from almost zero interest rates to the historical average, which is closer to 4.5%. So I think this is a calculated long-term strategy, and I haven't heard the media talking about it. I think just like the sequester, this minority wants this to happen because it will further their long-term goal of shrinking government. Final point, if that's the case, then I think President Obama has to get off his throne and actually take the LBJ role of knocking heads and trying to force a negotiation. He will be no worse off. End of point.
So, Starve the Beast Part 2. Charlie, I think your analysis is dead on. Let me put in a couple of points. One, I was listening to Bill Moyers on Sunday, and he gave probably the bitterest commentary I've ever heard him give. He started out by saying, this is about people who refuse to let democracy work. And partly he said, the Citizens United case has resulted in the election of people who hate government so much they want to shut it down, who are unable to abide by the results of a democracy. Now, we had other people on the shows talk about the results of Citizens United, the 2009 decision, which essentially conferred citizenship rights on corporations, particularly First Amendment freedom of speech rights, which under the Valeo decision, which was earlier, said money and freedom of speech are the same thing, but allowed corporations to make unlimited campaign contributions and very much in secrecy. And you've had at least two of the people that I listen to, Melissa Harris-Perry and Rachel Maddow, at their panels, who both say corporations have bought their own representatives in Congress, primarily thanks to Citizens United. And the fact is that the speaker has also lost his leverage, because where they used to direct money to campaigns, his members, his Tea Party members, can raise their own funding through people like the Koch brothers and the others who are making these massive donations that were allowed partly as a result of that decision. And I'm one of those people who think that Roberts made that decision specifically with timing aimed at the 2010 census redistribution. Anybody want to pick up on that?
Well, I hear a consistency here, and the consistency is that there is a sort of intermediate business as usual, Republican and Democrat, and Bill Moyers is commenting, you know, how horrible it is from their perspective that people are now involved who don't agree with them. And then on the fringe, on the Occupy side and on the Republican minority congressman side, we have people who are saying, your system and what it implies for the American people is just plain wrong. And so I think there's a lot in that theory that this could be a very advertent strategy and very intelligently prosecuted, because they're saying the way in which you are going, which is spend, declare wars, you know, make it good for business because you could rebuild the houses you've torn down, that kind of attitude is simply unacceptable, and therefore they're prepared to go to a place where, say, Moyers and right-thinking people just can't imagine that an American would want to do.
Bruce, do you have any comment on Charlie's point about driving up interest rates as the underlying mission of the people behind the shutdown and behind what looks like the first default on the U.S. debt?
You know, this reminds me of back in 1981 with President Reagan, where you used the deep tax cuts to create deficits that then became a hammer to create the pressures to have deep cuts in domestic spending. I don't know whether they have thought it through the way Charlie has, but I'll tell you, it's plausible. And if these folks, you know, are doing this to create, you know, a crisis where the interest rates are pushed up significantly, it's demonic and it's frightening. And frankly, it, you know, what Bob was saying, you know, this is a fundamental threat to the whole democratic process, to majority rule, you know, to the system that we have. You know, you're using revolutionary means. And from an institutional standpoint, that's just absolutely frightening.
But if you are a kamikaze conservative, Bruce, you don't mind losing in the short run if you think it's going to promote your long-term goal. And I think, unfortunately, that is the mindset.
Bob, you talk about the manager kings, the CEO coup d'etat. We've got a minute to break, but Do you think that all of these manager kings are kamikaze conservatives who
are
behind
this? No. Quite the reverse. The manager kings are in favor of the way things are going. In the purchased Republican and Democratic Party, they are now, incredibly enough, almost disempowered as the level of what should I say, strategic intrigue that Charlie's talking about is simply beyond them. They haven't bought these guys, although they did pay for their campaign. So therefore, for a very great rarity in recent America, something is happening that is not in the control of the Chamber of Commerce.
On that note, we have to go to break, but I want to pick this up when we come back.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
The Mayan calendar tells us that we will be entering into a 260-day opportunity for us to engage in conscious co-creation with Great Spirit. How will we prepare ourselves for this exciting and unprecedented time in Earth's history? Peter Tung has dedicated over 20 years of his life's work to exploring that which is beyond understanding. Peter will help increase your awareness and education on this enlightening transformation in consciousness. Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation airs live Wednesdays at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on 7th Wave Network. Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Global Reach. I'm your host, Tay Revez, and I am here with three extraordinary guests. Bob Monks, the author of the book Citizens Disunited, Passive Investors, Drone CEOs, and the Corporate Capture of the American Dream, Charles Cobb, the president of the French American Foundation, U.S., and Bruce Fried, president of the Center for Political Accountability. But when we went to break, you said, first time in history we have something not controlled by the Chamber of Commerce. You also, and you may have swallowed the words, you talked about the purchase of the Democrat and Republican parties. Do you want to pick up on that? When we went to break, I heard a little comment about genie out of the bottle.
Well, this is Bruce. You have now is the genie that has come out of the bottle, where you had the Chamber of Commerce that was deeply involved in underwriting the Republican takeover of or wins of 2010, bringing in people who turned out to be almost the total antithesis to the type of politics you had before. I mean, you brought in revolutionaries, and one could argue also reactionaries, who are looking to upend the rules and bring about significant change from their standpoint, but doing it by basically thumbing their nose at the system.
So I have a question for the three of you: is the U.S. still governable? Why don't pick that up, Charlie?
I think so. I think the Constitution's still there, but of course that's a document of words. It's not a government of people trying to enforce the laws. I think so, but I do think it's going to take. We don't have the type of leaders that we had before. People who were respectful of one another's differences, but at the same time willing to compromise. I'll tell you something I heard in Washington last week, which just dumbfounded me. I was in Washington, where I lived for 33 years. I was back for 4 days last week at a symposium that we did on cybersecurity, and I heard two people, one a lobbyist, another a policy guy, tell me that what we needed to change Washington, to get the political parties able to engage, is to, I'm not kidding, bring back earmarks. The argument was that with the abolition of earmarks, the party leadership in each party was unable to enforce discipline. And I thought, for goodness sake, we basically, that argument means that you have to hand out money to people in your own party to get them to do the right thing. I was just astounded when I heard that. So, yes, I think the country is governable, but I think we're going to have to go through a few more crises before we kind of clear the decks and have some solid leadership in both parties to bring back our senses.
This is Bruce. I think
that was actually a point also on the Melissa Harris-Perry show, that actually the loss of earmarks was one of the causes of the loss of power that the Speaker had, and which has given all the power to these people who are funding or buying candidates, essentially, picking their own candidates and funding their elections.
I actually, John McCain, if I'm correct, never took an earmark. Absolutely opposed them. That's been my view.
But it's in the congressional district, and it's also on the state level. Remember, we have all these state legislatures, and a lot of money has gone in there from the very conservative groups, the groups that are being funded by the Koch brothers and others to get.
Yeah, but as Bob knows,
elected.
some of this money goes to the private sector.
But is that? All right.
This is Bruce. I think that there's a more fundamental issue, and I think it has been raised by Tom Mann at the Brookings Institution and Norm Ornstein at the American Enterprise Institute when they said, it's worse than you think it is, where there has been a fundamental change within the Republican Party. It's something that really has been building over many years, where you have a party that really has is deeply split, has a driving force that really has tremendous difficulty dealing with change. I mean, you see this in the demographic splits between the parties, and with the way the House has been redistricted, it has inordinate power much greater than in fact its support, but it uses it almost to fight a losing battle. There is a frenzy, there is a mission, that you see that has brought us to this point of shutdown, and where you really find it very difficult to have the type of negotiations that you would have in the past that would provide a way out. And I think that's something that really needs to be looked at. And you have to take a look at how the parties are funded, where the driving force really comes from, to understand what the problem is that we have and how you, whether you can deal with it.
I think one also has to take another look at the way apportionment is done after a census, because the fact is there, in terms of popular vote, the Democrats got 5 million more votes in the House than the Republicans did, yet you have a Republican House majority. So something needs to be done there. But we talked about earmarks. I mean, the interesting thing is now we don't have earmarks for representatives to bring the bacon home to their districts, and not all earmarks were bad. But we do have bills that contain what we could call earmarked benefits for very specific companies, not just for industries. In your book, Bob, you cited the fiscal cliff negotiations and that little provision that was put in for Amgen's benefit, and right now the House has just voted on a bill on genetically modified organisms, GMO bill, that has special provisions that, if not in name, will certainly benefit Monsanto enormously. So
I see a lot of this as being the reflection of the world in which the conventional political parties have been captured by the Chamber of Commerce. And the implication of this is that too few people are enjoying the benefits of government. Too few people feel that government is positively affecting them. The reason being, because government has such a very clear driving force, being the maximization of profit of the large businesses represented by the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable. So you have an atmosphere within which there is a general disinclination to find satisfaction from government. So as different groups like Occupy or these right-wing Republicans today, they're out there saying, look, something is wrong. And when they say something is wrong, I don't know what the data is, but historically, it's probably pretty close to as large a percentage of people in a peacetime have ever said that, agree with them. So you have an atmosphere within which there is not really a great deal of energy and enthusiasm for a restoration of the traditional institutional arrangements.
Well, let me ask you something. My high school social studies teacher said no people ever had a government they didn't deserve. Do we deserve this government, and what did we do to deserve it? Bruce.
No, you don't deserve it, but the fact is, it's, you know, we're in the midst of a serious political crisis. I would argue that it might be, you know, the most serious crisis that we have faced in since the Great Depression or the Civil War before that, where you hear you have a very determined minority that is determined to really thwart the will of the majority and the ability of a government to function. It's going to require, some major choices among the electorate. We haven't had those. Well, clearly, you've had them at the presidential level, but, you know, in the off-year elections, in between, when voter turnout is much lower, then you end up with different results in Congress that have created divided government and I would say dysfunctional government.
Perhaps
hey,
the blame is
Charlie.
Americans' disinclination to vote. Sorry, Charlie, I think you were going to say something.
Yeah, I want to just be counterintuitive here and just say, no, I think we're getting the government we deserve. And the reason I say that is because I think there are far too many people who have opted out of civic engagement. And let me give you two examples. After 9/11, President Bush, who went on, by the way, for a brief period of time to enjoy stratospheric approval, I think 92-93% approval, which he then squandered in the next election when he politicized the issue. But he told the American people, go shopping. Okay? Is that what we do in our democracy? That's my first point. Number two, I have a French friend who I met with in August in Paris, and he said to me, Charlie, I'm just amazed that more Americans aren't outraged over the surveillance issues that have surfaced, both from the government sources and also in the private sector, the sort of metadata gathering. Nobody seems to care. So if that's the attitude, one of apathy, we get exactly what we have right now.
There was a comment from, I think it was The Economist, actually questioning the U.S. ability to be governed. But has this gone global? I mean, is this just a U.S. problem with the manager kings, or has this really started to impact the other democracies or the other non-democracies?
Well, not Germany. I mean, one may disagree with their views on austerity, but they don't seem to have this issue right now.
What about France?
I think that it's oftentimes forgotten, but
the informing energy for the United States was not efficiency. The informing energy for the United States was to avoid the exercise of unaccountable power. And I see now, with the enormous power that we've seen, has there ever been any power that allows a president to decide he wants to go invade a country and spend $1 trillion for reasons that have never been explained to anybody ever?
Very good question.
I mean, with that kind of track record, can you imagine why a country would want to continue that particular mode of functioning? So I see in our own what you know, that wonderful expression of Churchill's about, you know, Americans will keep making the worst possible judgments in the world until the last one, and you know that we're saying we don't like it, we're not going to stand for it anymore, and we aren't doing it very elegantly. After all, this is what America is. I mean, America wasn't about having Versailles and having people, you know, kowtow to the dukes and the king. America was about free people trying to express themselves in a world where, you know, there's a lot of ignorance and we really don't know what we're doing most of the time.
We had the director of National Intelligence, Mr. Clapper, in March of this year, lie to a Senate committee. He lied directly to Senator Ron Wyden, and I believe he was under oath. When he was asked, you know, are you collecting certain types of data, the answer was no, not wittingly. Then after the Snowden leaks, it became clear that, yes, we were collecting that data wittingly. And when he was called on it, asked, you know, to explain why he lied to the Senate, his answer was, I believe, quote, it was the least untruthful, close quote, thing I could say.
Which is outrageous.
Absolutely outrageous.
The reason I
absolutely
asked you about,
outrageous.
Let me go on there. The reason I asked you about Gone Global is that the Trans-Pacific Partnership talks have been pretty secretive. And there are, and for example, they have shown members of the Senate texts of chapters, but they can't have their aides there, and they can't take notes, and they can't take anything home. But what's been leaked is that a lot of this negotiation has nothing to do with trade. It is about reducing labor costs. It is about including powers to undercut another country's environmental laws, further financial deregulation, caps on food safety protection, and some other things that are, you know, very good for some corporations, but not good for others. And I'm wondering if we've seen the corporate capture now of this negotiation.
I would have thought that this is the expression of corporate policy. I mean, this is why, in a sense, corporations function outside the national limits, and countries have trouble doing it. Corporations don't. And so, rather than waiting for legislation and for international law, you simply create agreements among businesses as to how they're going to conduct themselves.
But the question is, are you expanding trade, or are you finding a way to defund the EPA or defang the EPA and other countries? I mean, Australia's environmental laws and others. So, and I tried to get information. I went to some of my partners overseas in Australia and a couple of the other countries that are part of this. And this was originally supposed, the original idea of this negotiation was for the United States to sort of form this circle of countries that would create the standard operating procedures for trade, for food safety, and give the U.S. and the others leverage over China, something that seems to be totally going by the wayside. Let me go, we're reaching the end of the segment, and I really want to start talking about, are we at a tipping point? Are the people who are calling for change going to get it? And how are we going to turn things around? Because really, your book and the last two chapters, Bob, are a call for people to take control back, and for investors in particular, to sort of take control back from the corporate kings. But we're going to go to break now, and we will take this up when we get back.
What's going on behind the scenes with your favorite Voice America show or host? For the latest news, visit the iRadio blog at iradioblog.com.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Did you know that at the root of every business problem lies a communication issue? Communication Nation, a show that brings effective business communication practices to the masses, addresses a number of topics and talking points that impact your professional development, as well as business productivity and profitability. Host Jill Schiffelbein makes the theoretical tangible. Tune in each Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Be ready to become a better communicator with Communication Nation.
What's going on behind the scenes with your favorite Voice America show or host? For the latest news, visit the iRadio blog at iradioblog.com.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to our final segment of Global Reach. I'm here with my guest, Charles Cobb, president of the French American Foundation U.S., Bruce Fried, president of the Center for Political Accountability, and Bob Monks, author of the amazing book, Citizens Disunited, Passive Investors, Drone CEOs, and the Corporate Capture of the American Dream. So what are the solutions to the corporate capture or the corporate purchase of the American political system and economy? Because, and why should we care as international businesses?
I think the only solution really that has a chance is for the owners of corporations to express their own interest. And the interest of the owners is very different from the interest of the managers of the businesses. And that, of course, is why we've seen this incredible, unprecedented rise in executive pay, which is as accurate as a body temperature thermometer to show you, you know, what is the condition of the corporate body. The owners have to...
The corporations we disapprove of or refuse to invest in certain industries?
I don't think refusing to invest in certain industries is very availing, because the problem with that is that there's always money, and people will invest in things that will make money. You can't really, by divesting, achieve anything worthwhile. What you need to do is to become engaged and involved and to, in effect, make the company be your company if you're an owner. And so the challenge is just like democracy. The challenge is the corporate quality will be a function of the effective involvement of the owners, much like the state of democracy is.
Charlie.
I'm not sure yet. Let me think. Give me a couple of minutes on this. I'm trying to formulate my thoughts. I'm basically an optimistic person, so there is an answer to this.
I want to pick up on the divestiture point. Back when I was editing Business International, was part of that time was the height of the South Africa divestiture movement. And I was on the unpopular side of that, saying that really I thought that U.S. and European companies should stay there and start training the next group of managers for the South African side, and also to exercise leverage over South Africa. That was, either popular or unpopular. Bob, you wrote about that in your book.
Yes.
Hey, this is Charlie. Let me try and answer. Pick up on something I heard from Richard Nixon, the first U.S. president I ever met, who was obsessed with communications. I think to get a breakthrough here, we need to come at it the way some of us came at campaign finance reform in the run-up to the 2002 McCain-Feingold bill, and that is actually to have a communication strategy, to plot out an approach which involves exposure, transparency, confrontation, information to the American people. I think the more that individuals and companies are shamed by their behavior, that the good sense of the American people will swing into action and help change this. I remember people who told me, and Bruce may remember this, that we'd never get campaign finance reform. We did. It did some good things. It didn't fix everything. But I think actually having a communication strategy building on some of the ideas of the Tea Party and of Occupy Wall Street, and actually having a strategy that aims at corporate behavior, at individual, at big investors, I think this can be done.
Bruce, talk about the work that you're doing to bring about good governance, transparency, and accountability to corporations, at least in the political spending sphere.
I think we have done significant work because we have thought through what the issues and the challenges are. The fact that political spending does pose a serious risk to companies and investors. Political spending that is not disclosed, that is not done in an accountable manner, that is not in the long-term interests of companies, really works against, the best interests of a society in which a company operates. We have articulated this. We have put together a coalition of investor partners who engage companies, and the engagement of companies is very important because it leads to changes in policies and practices, but it also raises with companies directly these issues that need to be addressed. We are looking at developing a course for business schools on corporate political accountability that could be integrated into the business school curriculum. The goal is really to try to get directors and managers to take a broader view of their responsibilities, their company's responsibilities, and have this reflected in the way their company engages in the political process and really becomes part of the whole body politic. I think we're making progress on that front. We see that companies that there are a growing number of companies that want to have good governance, good corporate governance policies on this. I mean, there's a great deal of work to be done. I think, the critique that Bob has made is dead on, and it really shows you sort of the sort of counter pressures we have to deal with, the uphill nature of the fight. But I think, we have started making progress addressing some of these issues and bringing about, in the long term, some rather fundamental reforms and fundamental changes in behavior.
Bob, your basic call to arm is a call for shareholder engagement. What are some of the ways that the nominal or less nominal shareholders can engage in a way to start changing the situation?
Well, I think as a start, if everyone who listens to this broadcast understands that one of the largest and most significant shareholders of all publicly traded companies is their university. And if everyone makes it their business to go through the bureaucracy of their alumni associations and their boards of trustees, and first of all asks, what is the policy of the university as it is an owner of all of these companies? What are they doing? And if they don't, I can tell you the answer is nothing. But let's just skip over that part of the process. And let's just say, why aren't they doing something? They're, after all, they're places that teach ethics. I mean, exactly the line that Bruce was outlining about a course for a business school. This should be standard in every place. Because people have to understand we're living in a world where business is important. So it's important that people understand the language of business and how to relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what everybody individual ought to do is to attempt to energize questioning of boards of trustees of foundations and universities.
Bruce, you've tried to deal with some of the university endowment trustees. What's been the result there?
I think that there are some serious issues. You know, that when you're dealing with university endowment trustees, you also have this the same phenomena with some of the very large foundations, where there are very close ties to the corporate sector that I think may make an effort like that to be much more difficult. I found that
difficult. It is.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, there are real conflicts. One would hope that university trustees would take a broader view, and the same thing with some of the trustees of the big foundations. But many of them come out of the, or at least a significant number come out of the corporate sector, and they bring the type of mindset that Bob has been focusing on.
Bob, do you think that just the ordinary non-corporate alumni can make a difference, or the students currently going to those universities?
You know, it's a difficult problem. Students are only there for 3 or 4 years, and the universities are fairly imaginative about finding ways to use their energies that wear out before they graduate. By the time they graduate, it's hard to rely on students alone, but students do raise the issues. There's no question but that the situation is a difficult one because of the interrelationship between large business and, say the people who are trustees of the most prestigious universities and colleges. But is that a phenomenon that we can put up with? That's why I say that for people like listening to this show, I mean, it's your university. If we're going to put up with that, I mean, the Lord knows we're in deep trouble if we're not going to be willing to get accountability from something in which we have an ownership interest in by virtue of being there.
Well, speaking of broad ownership interest, let's take a different group of trustees, the trustees of the public pension funds. They tend to be very long-term holders of stock. And I know, at least in my state, you have the state's controller, Tom DiNapoli. You have the current public advocate, Bill de Blasio, who is the odd-on favorite to become the next mayor of New York, who have both worked, Bruce, with your organizations to bring about corporate accountability and corporate transparency. And I know that Tom DiNapoli has also put in shareholder resolutions to have companies that are engaged in fracking make the risk public to their shareholders. Is that a better route than, has that been a more productive route for you than going through the endowments?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tom DiNapoli is one of the leaders in this. You know, when he became state controller, then the New York State Common Retirement Fund really became a truly activist shareholder in the best sense of the word. The comptroller's office files many resolutions at companies urging them to adopt disclosure and accountability in their political spending. That to me, you know, they've been one of the folks we have really relied on and worked most closely with over the years. So, you know, they've been significant agents of change. New York City comptroller also has been a major supporter
John
of disclosure.
Lou.
And, that was the case under Bill Thompson.
Okay, well, I will say that the probable next controller, Scott Stringer, has actually committed to do the same thing.
This is what I understand, and we look forward to working with him.
And he and Tom DiNapoli are likely to be future guests on this show, I will add. So maybe one or all of you will come back and question them. What about the other prong of this, the big endowments?
Well, they have the same problem with them you have with the universities. They're very much inclined to come from a group of people who are essentially senior corporate officers, and therefore they're very reluctant to try to be perceived in their own social circles as being critical of the corporate management.
But Bob, you talk about getting corporations to issue a bonus dividend rewarding committed holistic ownership. Can you expand on that a little bit? What's your thinking there, and what, how would you get it? What would be the result?
Well, I have to say it's a theory with a whole lot of problems, but the idea is that if you want to do something in a world, the currency is increasing value. You have to make it valuable for people to do things. A corporation is not a place for sort of general ethical principles. It's for commercial ethical principles. So if you say to someone, if you will commit a certain amount of energy to trying to organize ownership as a relevant factor in the governance of the corporation will reimburse you some expenses. The corporation may enhance the quality of your stock. Very difficult to do, but conceptually it's important to understand that it is in the corporation's interest and it is in the public's interest to have meaningful involvement by owners. And it is so difficult to achieve it without a system of incentive that one, it can be spared a certain amount of imagination in trying to conceive of a way to encourage such.
Do you think that would make mutual fund managers more likely to hold the stocks longer? I just wanted to quote John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard, who said, corporate managers are likely to try and shape government policy in a way that serves their own interest over the interest of shareholders. So do managers of mutual funds, which are huge holders of shares, have a role in trying to have corporations shape their policies in the interest of shareholders, and how would they do it?
Well, they could have a massive role. The problem for them is that they have a genuine conflict of interest because all of them are in the business of trying to sell other services to the corporations. So if you're Fidelity, for example, and your most profitable business is being the service agent for 401k plans, and companies' managements have to hire you to run the 401k plans, it's highly unlikely that you're going to be very much incentivized to try to take exception with how that management runs the business.
Just like the corporate bond rating agencies.
Yes, same thing exactly. And there are several ways of dealing with this. I mean, one is we might just enforce the law. I mean, these people are all fiduciaries, and dealing with a conflict of interest in your own interest is patently illegal. It is simply that our system is so rife with it that we've even given up the notion of trying to consider such an old-fashioned thing as obeying the law.
Well, we are almost out of time here. On the other remedy side, maybe, Charlie, you'll pick this up. What about going through the Disclose Act, the Shareholder Protection Act, or getting the SEC to move? Are any of those a viable option?
Yes, the short answer. I would fold that approach into the overall communication strategy, and I would make a suggestion here, and that is that if there are foundation representatives who are listening to this program, I think a lot of organizations could use the type of foundation support that was that helped underwrite the work that led up to the McCain-Feingold bill. I mean, we need support to help these groups sustain their message. And it's very important, in my view, for the health of our democracy. So I want to give some more thought as to how one might actually organize this. This is something you might want to talk about in a future program today. But I do think that having a communication strategy and mapping out, you know, just like those Tea Party people, if I'm right on the strategy, they have a long-term goal. We need to take the suggestions from Bob, the good work that Bruce has been doing, and put it into a comprehensive strategy with an end game and a set of milestones along the way. And that would include, wherever possible, getting into members of Congress, getting into hearings, representing what would now be minority views, but which I actually think are the views of most of the American public. Because I think most Americans don't want to see our small-d democracy squandered in this way and overtaken by a small number of interests who have their own axes to grind.
Would you all be willing to work on this? We're out of time, so it can only be a yes or no.
Yes.
You bet.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take this up in the future, offline and online, and questions, comments, suggestions from our listeners are all welcome. Thank you so much for being on this show. Bob Monks, Charlie Cobb, Bruce Fried, thank you. You guys have been terrific.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Thanks.
And thank you all for listening to Global Reach. Use the next week to extend your international reach. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.